Okay, so I've got my notes up here, Will, and
lovely.
They fill a stamp, a postage stamp.
Oh, good. That's good. I'm so glad you've done your homework.
Thank you, Will.
Mahan Bukal Quivin.
The best bits. I'll use small words that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
You are stupid. You have no taste, a lousy sense of humor, and you smell.
Don't call me stupid.
Hello, and welcome to The Best Bits, a movie podcast where we pick our favorite scenes from randomly selected, weirdly specific themes.
Yes!
This is your co-host, William, a writer of three films, plus a Star Wars. And I'm joined once again by my co-host and writer of One and a Bit Films and Four and a Bit Episodes of Television Entertainment, Kevin Lehan. Kevin, how are you doing? Woo!
Why do you always leave out the Christmas special when you do your own intro? Are you not proud of the Christmas special?
Because it's been...
I always just squeeze that in.
It's because, you know what happened? It's been removed from my text.
Three films, a Christmas special, and a Star Wars. You removed it from your own text.
I somehow removed it from my own text.
It must be great for you to have so many credits that you can just decide, I'll leave that one on.
I should put it in.
Because I have to start boosting things up. I did a bit of this film, can I put the bit in? I'm grand.
And I should actually have it in now because we're in that time of the year. I've done a Christmas thing.
Easter.
Yeah. Yeah, we're Easter. That's it.
We've got the Easter eggs in the supermarket and I'm, yeah. Yes, it's Christmas.
It is indeed.
Isn't it a horrible time of year? A time when suicides go up.
No.
It's dark out.
No.
All you remember is everyone you've lost.
No.
It's a horrible, horrible time of year. And if you out there feel the way that I do, solidarity.
And if you feel the way I do, which is like I'm like a giddy child driving around the countryside with my kids in the backseat going, oh, I like that Christmas tree. Ooh, I like that Christmas tree.
That makes it worse. That's you now gloating. Like, look, there's a lovely bridge that you can jump off of. Look at that. That's a lovely view. Wouldn't you not love to jump off this bridge? Isn't it beautiful here?
It also is a time of year which is incredibly stressful because we're all stressing. It brings up stress in so many different ways. So I do my mindfulness and I go, you know, you have to enjoy the joy of Christmas and that ramp up to Christmas because as soon as Christmas Day is done, it's done. As my mother used to say, can I say this about my mother? Peggy Collins.
You can say whatever you want.
After Christmas dinner is finished, every Christmas, right? Once Christmas dinner was finished, she would stand up and throw her hands in the air and she would declare,
"Thank fuck, it's over!"
Would she really?
Yes! And I used to say, why do you say that?
Her heart broke. That just gives great insight into what poor Peggy had to put up with. Was she not even looking forward to Women's Little Christmas?
But listen, she didn't drink.
Would she actually even do anything for Women's Little Christmas?
For those
that don't know, there's a Cork tradition, which is that on the 6th of January, which is the official end of Christmas, when the decorations come down, you have Christmas that is specifically for the women to put their feet up. The bars in town, they have half-price drinks for the women. And they get to be treated on that day because for the rest of Christmas, they have to work and work like a fucking dog.
I used to ask Peggy, I said, why do you say that? Why do you say that about Christmas? Because I love it. And I know it's now as a parent, I realize how grueling it is. But she says, I just don't know. I always hated it, even as a little child. I was like, oh my God.
I'm like Peggy.
Yeah.
I'm like Peggy. I don't like it. I just find it a horribly grim time. But then we've had so many deaths in my family at Christmas time, so you know.
Yay! Christmas cheer. Another one's kicked the buckus.
I'm just offering my point of view, Will. That's all I'm doing.
Wow. Thank you very much for that gracious segue into this episode's topic, which is best point of view scene, Kevin.
And that's my full contribution to the episode because Will... I can tell you this right now. Sometimes we get winners, sometimes we get losers. And I feel like this might actually be the shittest topic that we've gotten ever on the podcast. Absolute fucking waste of time, useless. And I blame our patrons.
Was it them who gave it to us? Because it was the patrons gave
they
it.
They voted for it.
Lads.
As I've and often said to you, they're a bunch of cunts. And they picked this for us. We are now. We've got to try and fashion an hour of entertaining chat about POV scenes.
This is going to be an exercise. Take it away. A 60-minute exercise in polishing a turd on Mike. Well, I suppose the way
we've done
I,
it before.
I was, I again, as you were saying, it's just like POV. How do we do a topic on POV? And then I did start to do a wee bit of research, a little bit of the old research, and I was like going, well, okay, I'm a screenwriter. The moment happens when you're writing a screenplay where you write those letters POV, or maybe not POV, maybe we don't write them anymore, I don't know if you write them, but you specifically as a screenwriter, it's one of those few moments where you kind of go, I need to direct the movie right now. I need to direct the reader's eye.
I always feel icky when I have to put it in because I feel like I am breaking, it's like switching up your tenses if you were writing a book and suddenly going first person for a paragraph, and it just feels like, no, you know, you've presented the form of which the story is going to be told, and then to switch it up. But sometimes you absolutely need it. In my last script that I wrote,
No, I was just looking at a beautiful high loader that just gracefully went past my window, and that's what
I just saw your POV change, and I thought, what's he? In my last script, I had a character who couldn't see properly, and so in order to put that across, I had to have a point of view moment where you saw what they saw. So you would see the level of disability they were dealing with. So they couldn't see faces clearly because it was going to play into the story. It was going to become part of the narrative. So it was necessary, but I always feel like, ugh, I don't like doing it. I like subtly directing the eye on the page.
Yes. Sometimes subtle doesn't come across then when people are actually reading the script and they don't get it. But you kind of, you're hoping
that's because most people are idiots. Yeah. And as, was it William Goldman said, the ability to read a script well in Hollywood is rarer than the ability to write a script well.
Oh, that's actually a very good statement. The reason we put it into the screenplay is because we know, as people who are writing movies, who are imagining the movies in our head, we know when you use a POV shot in action, when it's presented in cinema, it's as organic and intuitive as blinking. Because we experience our entire lives through our own personal POV shots. So we can relate to just going into someone else's point of view. It's second nature to us.
You know what's weird, right?
Yeah.
Think of this. We are essentially just arms, chest, legs, feet, hands.
Yeah. Bit of a nose.
And a bit of a nose. And that's it. We never see our own heads. We're just consciousness floating above this body. Isn't that really weird when you think about it?
Yes.
Like if you didn't have a mirror, if you didn't have a reflection to see yourself, you'd be like, what's going on here? Like, what do I look like? My gorge is so hot. Like,
I can hear you squeaking that turd.
Get that though when you're out walking about and people are glancing at you, and you think, "Fuck, I must be kind of like, I must be rocking it today because I'm getting all these like glances. Like, oh look, oh, hey,
that's oi, oi. And you just forgot it was New Thursday.
Do you remember? I think I told you this before on a Die Hard thing. There was a time when I was a kid. Well, no, I was a youth. I was a teenager. And I accidentally burned down a...
The statute of limitations have probably run out on that particular crime, hopefully.
I tried very, very hard to put out the fire. I thought, well, play it cool, act cool, don't, like, give it away. And so I was standing with the crowd, looking at the flames, shitting bricks, and I was going, what happened? What happened? Like,
yeah.
Little did I know that my entire face was blackened with smoke.
Yeah.
So
self-incriminating. That's an example. That's a, like, I know it's a funny anecdote, right? But it's an example of directing the audience's point of view, but flipping it to reveal some information which kind of completely changed the context of the story. And it's a great use of point of view, how point of view can help us in storytelling. And one of the big things, one of the reasons I'll use point of view in a story is basically just to get the audience in their headspace, not just like see what they're seeing, but see the world through their eyes for a moment. And that can be utilized because basically, Kevin, this is the way I probably broke it down, was I was like going, oh, you can actually kind of like use POV shots in different genres, kind of like elicit different emotions and whatnot. It's primarily used in horror movies to great effect, thriller movies, action movies, rom-coms, pretty much the gamut. And I kind of broke them down into little specific categories. You love that word. Here we go. Categories.
A turn up for the books.
One of my favorite things to do, which is to list things.
I have my list.
Right.
But you take it away. You guide me then.
Yeah, I wonder if you can stick them into, if you can find a way of slotting it in here, it would be great, right? So for instance, you can use POV shots to convey love or romance, right? If you have, you know,
a
character sitting on a bench and all of a sudden a bus pulls up and, you know, we are looking at this person who steps off that bus and the world kind of stops as the character's heart begins to thump and beat because the person who's stepping off that bus is the epitome of beauty, the epitome of perfection. Someone, you can feel them falling in love with this individual.
So stall on a second, because I think we need to clarify this now, because if you think of basic geometry within a shot, composition in a film, you will have what's called an over-the-shoulder shot, which is you're in a subjective point of view. The audience has got like a god's eye. So you're seeing things sort of the character's point of view. You're over their shoulder, mm-hmm. but it's not directed at a point of view. A proper point of view shot or a scene or a film is you're inside the character's point of view. So it's like you're looking through binoculars, or you're like the killer's point of view. You're like the shark in Jaws looking up at Chrissy swimming. That's the shark's point of view.
Absolutely. And this is the person who sees a goddess or an Adonis walking towards them. You know, those particular moments, the film presents the person as the character sees them.
Yes.
Like, for instance, I'll give you an example. So a quick example, like, you know, is in, for instance, in The Royal Tenenbaums.
He had made a request for his usual escort, the one from his days on the circuit, to meet him at the pier by way of the Green Line bus. Hi. As always, she was late.
When Luke Wilson's character is at a bus stop and Margot Tenenbaum, Gwyneth Paltrow, steps off the bus and he's just looking at her and time seems to slow down as she looks straight down the lens, and we know when she's looking straight down the lens, she's looking at Luke Wilson, but we are seeing her through Luke Wilson's point of view. So it's very much his subjective point of view on her and how he sees her.
I've been out walking. I don't do too much talking these days.
Whereas the subtly different version of that would be Cameron Diaz's introduction in The Mask, when you see Jim Carrey and his co-worker look at Cameron Diaz walk in and you're seeing what they're seeing.
Spoken!
Okay, so see, when I was doing my list now, mm-hmm. I thought one genre of films that I don't particularly love, I'm not really excited by this genre. And it was in our wheel for the longest time. And I'm glad we didn't get it because it would be a bit of a chore to get through. Mm. But now I feel like it's probably the time to bring it up. And I don't know whether it's in your list or not, but it's found footage films.
Yes. Found footage films are POV movies.
Totally.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm scared to close my eyes. I'm scared to open them. I'm going to die out of here.
Yeah, I'm not a massive fan of found footage films.
No, because I feel, right, I was watching a YouTube one just recently and I cannot remember the name of it now, but it was a film that was made for about $800. And what happens to me often with found footage films is I admire the ability to be able to pull it off, like the effort it took to tell a story in such a limited window. Mm. Because with a found footage film, you're limited to only what's caught on camera. Mm-hmm. So anything that happens off camera, you can't cut away to anything else. You're sort of, it's mostly real time, unless you're doing the Cloverfield thing of it's like you're taping over something else. You're getting to see backstory that way, which was very, very clever.
Yeah.
But the adherence to the form and trying to make sure that everything is captured on camera adds to the artificiality of it.
Yeah.
So even though they're trying to present realism, it just feels more false because mm-hmm. everything has to be stated to camera. And it's like, are you getting that? Did you see that? That kind of like...
You feel the contrivance
overdone. Yeah, the contrivance. That's exactly what I'm looking for. The contrivance just leaves me grimacing and having to get through it because I know it's like very obvious exposition.
Yeah. And the example, okay, there's a couple of examples that popped ahead. Obviously, the most famous found footage film, the one that kind of like kickstarted that and made that kind of subgenre a huge thing, was the Blair Witch Project. And I still think, even though the Blair Witch Project, you know, I don't love that film, but there's things about it I really like. I think they actually kind of did it well on that one because of the...
Very, very scary in the cinema. That really like put the willies up me.
Yeah, it was. But I feel it was the parameters that they actually gave the young actors at the time. They didn't say, it wasn't orchestrated. They actually just went, take these cameras. We're going to scare the shit out of you in the woods. And you react.
It was improv. Like Larry David would do Curb Your Enthusiasm. They would have a premise. They would have a brief outline. In this scene, you're going to do this and this.
Yeah.
Go. And then they would just riff. But isn't it mad, to think back to how innocent we were in 1999. The novelty of it, to be like, is it real? I heard it's real. It might be real.
Yeah.
There's a website we can go on to. Now you think back, it's like, you fucking, it's almost like the people watching the train coming towards them and thinking, Jesus, Doc, it's going to knock us over.
Yeah.
October of 1994, three student filmmakers arrived in Burkittsville, Maryland to interview locals about the legend of the Blair Witch.
All I'm saying is that you got us lost.
No, I know we're not lost.
Oh, you knew that yesterday, too, and you knew that twice.
Look,
come more or less this way.
1 year later, their footage was found, but the three were never seen again.
Yeah, I remember. I remember being in the States at the time when the hype was building up for it, and there was a documentary on TV around the, you know, supposed real life disappearance of these kids. And the documentary was documentary was a part of the promotion of the whole thing. And I was kind of going, I thought, this is this real or is it not real? I was kind of half duped by it. And I feel, to your point about found footage films, because it doesn't have the over contrivance, because there is, as you said, improvisation going on with the camera work, with how they're reacting, it was like, go out there, capture as much footage as you can as we improvise, and let's see how it cuts together, rather than found footage, kind of like now more contemporary found footage films, which are fully scripted and blocked and staged, especially if you've got CG, like Chronicle, for example, that's got like, you know, huge amount of CG implemented in it.
I loved Chronicle at the time. That felt modern and full-bodied. It felt like you were getting a full story. It didn't feel shortchanged by its concept.
Andrew, stop! Don't hurt them! Andrew!
Yeah.
But do you remember, I'm sure we talked about this before, do you remember District 9? District 9 started out as almost a found footage film.
Yeah.
It wasn't found footage. It was more like a documentary.
Yeah.
And then it segued into a traditional film. And I always just felt that change up was a problem for me.
It was strange.
And nobody else was bothered by it. Yeah, it just felt like, no, you're cheating it. And then it got into that big naff, like mech suit, you know, showdown. I thought, what's going on here? I thought this was a documentary.
Yeah.
No, it's like orchestra swelling and stuff.
If you're doing a bit like that, you have to commit to the bit.
Absolutely.
Or, you know what I mean? Yeah. You kind of have to, you just kind of go, oh, if we're doing this documentary style, we're doing the whole thing documentary style. Or not.
That's just my personal taste, because that was a very successful Best Picture nominee film.
Was it?
You know, so, yeah.
Whoa.
Do you remember it was one of the first ones where they expanded the category to 10?
Yeah.
And then that slipped in there.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This year, all of us were kept on the edge of our seats by a film that was part science fiction, part terrifying thriller. Inspired by events in South Africa during the era of apartheid, this is District 9.
But Cloverfield, I think, is my favorite found footage film.
Right, okay.
Well, I don't know. You see, I don't really love the genre enough to be able to say I've got a favorite. Mm. Blair Witch scared the piss out of me in cinema. I don't know whether Paranormal Activity could be considered a found footage film.
I think it is. I think it kind of is.
It's cobbled together from security camera footage and webcams and stuff like that. Or no, what was that one? Searching. That was great.
What was Searching? I actually haven't seen Searching. That came out in the last 5 years, didn't it?
It's John Chu, Sulu from the J.J. Abrams movies. He's searching for his daughter.
Right.
Hey, Margot, dad again.
Last week.
It's been 4 days since Margot was last seen.
Critics and audiences became obsessed with Searching. Don't miss a twist.
Where were you the night my daughter went missing?
Searching.
Host as well was quite good.
Oh, wow.
That little one that was made during the...
COVID, yeah.
COVID, yeah. Lockdown.
Okay.
But I don't particularly love them. What I did love about Cloverfield, well, there was one thing that I absolutely detested about it. No one else agreed with me at the time, and now I think maybe some might agree with me. I found TJ Miller incredibly annoying in that film. A sort of sarcastic cameraman who kept putting in these little ad libs and interjections that were meant to be funny. It just irritated me. Mm. But I thought what was clever about Cloverfield was they taped over a previous recording, and so you got deeper backstory on the characters through these flashbacks, and I thought that's a clever way to do flashbacks in a film footage story.
It really isn't, and to my point earlier on, it's about they committed to the bit and they found creative ways of just giving us extra story using that narrative device.
I know what I'm talking about. Come on. Admit it, you are going to miss me a little bit, right?
Oh, yeah, I will.
Okay, yeah, all right, we're almost out of tape. We got like 3 seconds left.
What do you want to say? What do you want to say? Last thing to begin.
I had a good day.
Do you have a favorite film footage film?
I don't, like, I'm not mad into the genre. I'm not mad into it as a device because they don't feel cinematic enough for me. I want composed shots. I actually hate when you have someone just, you know, yanking a camera around and says, I'm a cameraman. And it's so as a result, they limit the films that are found footage films end up kind of feeling really constricted in my brain anyway. So I don't have a particular favorite one.
Can I also say I hate that so many sitcoms in the States do the fake documentary angle for their shows where they've copied the style that was made popular in the US with the US Office and they carried it over. Parks and Rec was like sort of a spin-off of The Office, but then Modern Family did it and now Abbott Elementary does it.
Yeah.
Looks to camera, those Jim-isms, I find them as unfunny as, do you remember you get the chain emails with get jokes? And it'd be like, scroll down, scroll, keep scrolling, scrolling.
I sent you two this morning.
I know you did. I print them off, you know. So
funny,
I've got them
it was
all there
funny.
In a book.
They're really
I'm
funny, weren't they?
Them.
I know what
but
you
But that's
mean.
What they do in those chain things with scroll down. You're going to love this. Keep going. Wait for it. Keep going. And then it's like, fuck off. That's not funny. It might have been funny if you didn't belabor it. Would like scroll this, wait for it, you're gonna love this.
Yeah.
And that's what I find looks the camera. Like it's the most basic low-hanging fruit.
It's funny because we've gotten used to it, it's almost become codified in sitcoms in that way, where it becomes codified where we almost like expect it or kind of feel not expected or not but like an audience almost feels like they're expecting it because like canned laughter or laughter in a sitcom back in the day.
I hate it though, because it calls attention to the fact that this is all artifice and it's fake. Yeah. And I'm just, they're going like, where's the documentary crew? Who's recording this? Who's this for?
I agree with you. POVs are really useful in scenarios where we have a character entering a new world, where they are kind of exposed to some huge transition in their lives. For example, one of my favorites, and I hope it's not your top one, but it's a film we've mentioned
it's
many
not.
Times.
My pick's going to be a Christmas film.
Oh, great. Okay, great. So, for example,
Die Hard.
RoboCop POV. The RoboCop POV when Alex Murphy is like becoming RoboCop and RoboCop is waking
up. Yeah.
That's
a great insight into... Well, there's two things. Yeah, it's him becoming RoboCop is great, but also the most moving part of that story is his memories.
Yeah.
Walking around his home.
It's excellent in that film. first of all, we're in his shoes. We're seeing these, we feel like a baby being born into the world. We are Robocop. And the way the kind of the executives are shuffling around and kind of adjusting his lens, it's almost, it's exciting. There's a building of excitement of like, oh, this, I'm special. I'm really good. And when that scene, that series of shots finally ends,
you're going to be a bad motherfucker.
The young executive saying, okay, list out your directives. And we see that close-up of Robocop. It's a really wonderful climax to this cool kind of like slow build-up. And again, when it's used, when we go into Robocop POV throughout, it's kind of cool because you get to see how brilliant his brain is and you powered along with him. It's the same as Terminator in a way.
We get the best of both worlds. The fastest reflexes modern technology has to offer, onboard computer-assisted memory, and a lifetime of on-the-street law enforcement programming. It is my great pleasure to present to you RoboCop.
Come on. That's for you.
Go, Robo.
But the one example that I want to use, that I want to kind of go, yay me and yay my film that I wrote, was in Wolfwalkers.
I'm looking forward to seeing it.
I have to bring this up because there was a moment in the writing of Wolfwalkers, the first draft, reached a point where the young boy at that particular time, because he was a boy in the first draft, he becomes a wolf. Oh, we really need to do something totally different here. Like, you know, so we need to kind of see the world from his point of view. Now, as a wolf, the world needs to change. I kind of went, golly, it would be really cool if we could do this in like first person point of view and actually see how a dog might see the world, which is primarily through scent. Like scents really are the primary input into how they navigate the world. And I remember stopping and writing an email to the directors, Tom and Ross, and I just went, come here, lads. I have this mad idea that like when we go into wolf vision, that we're going to see this, we're going to see the scent of animals that have been around like, you know, an hour beforehand, because they can actually calculate time.
Yeah, that's how they communicate and talk to each other.
And I said, could we do
that's
that?
That's why like, when you're walking a dog, let them smell and sniff around. Don't pull them on. When I see people walking their dogs and the dog just wants to sniff a pole or something and they yank the dog on, let the dog just sniff because he's actually having a chat with somebody.
But
and
what if the immersion is on at home, Kevin? What if you've left the immersion on?
You're fucked. Then you're fucked.
I knew in my head, right, in a 2D animated film, a flat 2D animated film, doing a point of view shot means a complete change of dimension, change of perspective. And I did not know if it was going to be achievable because I couldn't imagine how they would pull it off because it's like nothing they'd done before. And I just said, is there any chance we could maybe try and do it? And they just went, ah, yeah, we will.
Yeah.
But the,
I think they would have been delighted to have that opportunity because that's such a cool concept.
So I'm taking credit. I'm taking credit just for the initial idea. But the actual creation of the POV Wolf Vision in Wolfwalkers is kind of astounding because there was a team led by Evan McNamara is the name of the animator and his team of animators. They went and they actually created the forest and the town in virtual reality, in VR, which is incredible. Then they actually printed out each frame and hand drew then over the actual. So the end result is hand drawn. Like, so they actually used the kind of a VR template and then used the frames from the VR template to hand draw.
And then they filmed it with the actors?
Yeah, then they brought the actors along. Yeah, that's how it went. I just found it an astounding exercise in how they had a problem and how they were so ingenious in solving it using VR to actually create the effect. And honestly, there was a moment where I was like going, you know what? That's a pretty amazing POV shot, that whole the Wolf Vision stuff.
Huh? Merlin, can you smell that? Merlin, what's happened to you? I can see your scent.
And it's my pick.
Is it your pick? You said it was a Christmas movie, your pick was.
I'm looking forward to seeing it.
But my point here is, to RoboCop, the use of POV allowed the audience to experience, and the character to experience the world from a whole different point of view. And as a result, there's a level of excitement that comes with that.
So when you were talking, there were two things that came up in my mind. Wolfen had great POV moments that were kind of like the prototype for Predator vision. So you're seeing the world through the Wolfen's point of view, and it is stylized. It's like an inverted color palette. They overuse it in that film, but it stands out because I think that, you know, they were one of the first to utilize this kind of technology. Mm-hmm. And anytime where something is like really new and exciting, be like taking bullet time and just having like bullets going off every fucking 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But they use it too much in that film, but it did jump out at me. It was like, oh yeah, Wolfen. Talk about Wolfen. Because killer POVs come up an awful lot.
This is very important. Yeah.
The other thing is, you mentioned virtual reality. Like, mm-hmm. we're desperate to try and bring that into our own entertainment. I don't think it's going to take off, to be honest with you. It's just...
I love
it. It doesn't appeal.
I love it.
Yeah. I know, but you're like a gamer, so maybe that's the only place where it can work. Because this is the other thing, right? With an awful lot of these POV moments, you do get the sense that you're watching a video game almost. Mm-hmm. First-person shooter type thing.
Yeah.
But killer POVs, when the topic came up, I was like, yeah, I'm immediately seeing the killer's point of view.
Yeah.
But again, to jump topics again on you, because I don't know that this is going to come up. It's used to subtle unsettling effect in one film, Silence of the Lambs, the POV shots between Clarice and Dr. Lecter.
Good morning.
Dr. Lecter, my name is Clarice Starling. May I speak with you?
You're one of Jack Crawford's, aren't you?
I am, yes.
May I see your credentials?
It's coming up.
Certainly.
You brought up two topics that definitely are on my list, right? In the horror genre or in the kind of thriller genre, there are two POVs. You can have the Predator POV and the Prey POV. And in the example you used, I haven't seen Wolfen, but definitely in Predator.
Yeah.
The classic thermal vision that they use with the sound that underscores it.
You can hear the sound.
And it does something to your sinews where you kind of go, I like this. This is cool.
I can do the Predator noise. Do you want to hear it?
Please.
Okay. Can you hear that?
I want to say thank you to whatever it is that's filtering out that sound. So I didn't get to hear any of it, which I'm happy about.
That sucks. And hang on, I'm going to send you a WhatsApp.
Okay, yeah. I'll listen to it after we finish recording. But also kind of like in that realm as well, Peeping Tom absolutely is another example of POV.
Which I just watched for this topic.
Same.
Look out! Look out! Look out! Take care. You are being watched. We repeat, take care, for you are now alone with a killer. We warn you, don't let him see the fear in your eyes. For this is what he seeks, and this is why he kills.
What were your thoughts on Peeping Tom?
It's a little bit like a cross between the Carry On film and an Alfred Hitchcock film. Oh my God, Gaffner, what are you recording?
Yeah. I want to record women in fear.
Oh, why would you want to do that?
It's because my father beat me with a stick.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And I can see why it's so influential. You see, you got to put these films in context.
They were of their time.
Was it always camp, or is it just camp now in context with where we are today?
Yeah.
What did you think of it?
I'm very similar. There were elements to it where I found it's a bit... Even the main character, he was like, this effect is kind of like Peter Lorre figure. Yeah. And I was like, what's going on? But I think it's because his dad might have been German or something like that. But I found it really engaging.
Same.
Because it was dealing with ideas and concepts that were pretty radical at the time. I found it actually quite sympathetic to the main character, the actual killer, the serial bloody killer. It was a shockingly sympathetic portrait of him, I felt.
He was created.
It was nurture.
His father is the true evil in this.
That's what it was.
His father tortured him and it warped him, and he ended up trying to understand his father's abuse. He was killing women to see what his father saw. What is the fear that pulled him in? And he's a bit like Norman Bates. And funny that they came out at the same time.
It's very interesting. And like, this predates FBI profiling of serial killers. Like, FBI profiling serial killers didn't really start to become a thing until the late 1970s. And in that profiling, no, because I, you know, listen, we've all watched the serial killer documentaries and stuff like that. An awful lot of serial killers kind of had abusive childhoods where they had a parent who was abusive towards them. For this film in 1960 to actually go and take that leap and not completely cast them as in a damning light was, in my head, I think that might have been the more radical and disturbing element at the time.
The true evil in Peeping Tom is the dad.
Yeah.
And the true evil in Psycho is the murderer. And there's great POV shots in Psycho.
Yeah.
It would make a good double feature.
Absolutely. I found in Peeping Tom, like the first voyeuristic kill, I actually found that to be quite engaging.
Titillating.
Where he's, yeah, not titillating, but I was like, oh, crikey, okay. He's got this awkward camera under his coat and he's soliciting the services of a prostitute, and she takes him up to her apartment and the deed is done up there. But, it, you know, it's all a single shot. It was a POV, and I think that's, I said, what? This is very, very brave for its time.
I was stunned that it was like, it'll cost you £2.
Inflation, Kevin.
For the full works.
Inflation's a bitch.
You wouldn't get much for £2 nowadays. Fucking hell.
Jesus Christ.
Now, talking about the Predator POV. Now, going back to your Silence of the Lambs thing, that brings me into kind of the Prey, right? And I'm so glad you brought up Silence of the Lambs because it's a film I love. And I love it for how it uses POV shots, and particularly Clarice Starling's POV shot.
It's very intimate.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good word to use. But I find we actually experience the male gaze in that film through subtle POV shots, not just when she's like face to face with Hannibal Lecter, but when she's with the FBI instructor, when she's in, there's a shot when she's in a funeral home where we actually see men across the room looking straight down the camera, looking at her.
Yeah, exactly.
And you get mm-hmm. you get that sense of the male gaze, that sense of how...
Unsafeness.
Unsafe, and how you feel like you are prey. And I commend that film for doing that very subtly. And of course, then it's taken to the nth degree when she is in that iconic scene where she first meets Hannibal Lecter when she's walking down the jail cells, comes to his glass window, and he just emerges, and he's already locked eyes with her. You know, it's so intimidating. It's so creepy.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti. You fly back to school now, little starling. Fly, fly, fly.
That's one of my favorite films, Silence of the Lambs. And it's funny that it hasn't come up that much on the podcast, but it's one of those films where I will watch it anytime it's on.
Yeah.
Like Die Hard, like Wolfwalkers. Anytime I see it, I'll just watch it start to finish straight through.
Well, I agree. I'm there with you. I absolutely adore it. I really do. Another example of in horror, because obviously, look, POVs in horror is so critical.
Huge.
It's in every horror film, they utilize POV.
Halloween.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The Shining, which is one that I've gone on a bit of a buzz with recently.
What do you mean?
I started reading the big biography on Stanley Kubrick, and kind of got interested in like the process of like how he goes about adapting material, you know, and how he exploited screenwriters, had multiple screenwriters working on different versions of the script of scripts of every project, and they didn't know what they were working in.
You'd have to make peace with, yes, you worked on a great film, but boy, was it a miserable fucking experience.
I think from what I got from that big book I read, in his personal life, he was incredibly warm and incredibly welcoming. Right, he was great company.
I just have that memory of him constantly driving Steven Spielberg nuts by faxing at all hours of the day.
Yeah, he tormented him. He tormented him. And he was almost like a vampire where he would just consume all of the information you had. And he did some really horrible things to writers in that he would contract them and, like, you know, actually put them on a really limited contract, but not pay them. and force them to not work on any other projects or talk to anyone else about any other projects. And if he heard that they did, he would fire them and claim all the rights to the material and stuff like that. It did really shitty things to with writers. But the films are amazing, are absolutely amazing. And in The Shining, there are some incredible uses of the POV shot, really from the prey point of view, from Danny's point of view when he comes face to face with the twins in the corridor, and where he sees all these shocking images in the Overlook Hotel. But also even in that moment where Wendy, she's fleeing, you know, towards the end of the movie, she's just fleeing for her life, and she comes across a corridor and she looks down and she sees the furries, the guy in the teddy suit, you know, give the blowjob scene basically. But it's so shocking. It's really...
Is that what they were doing? I thought they were praying.
Well, one was praying on his knees and the other one was praying on his back, so I don't know. So, but that film utilizes,
takes me back to Mass,
POV shots to really unnerve you and instill and make you feel really small in this huge, cavernous, intimidating and scary place. I adore that film now, and I wasn't a fan of that film when it first came out, but I adore it. And now that I'm reading the book, I adore it even more, because my god, the adaptation from book to screen was kind of perfect. You pull back, the book has got all back, it's all backstory, all, like, you know, bits over here, bits over there, but the transition from book to screen was pretty excellent. Great adaptation.
I want to just add a little thing to that, which is, whenever I get the chance, I want to hype this film, because Stanley Kubrick buried it and he tried to limit its exposure because he felt that it would harm Dr. Strangelove. And that is Failsafe, which is a film that is fantastic. It's a black and white nuclear Armageddon story. Very serious, very tense, very gripping, brilliantly performed, excellently made. It's a Sidney Lumet film. It's got our own Bill O'Hurley is the name that I always say, and it's not Bill O'Hurley. It's
Bill O'Hurley,
isn't Dan it? O'Hurley.
Dan O'Hurley.
Dan O'Hurley.
Oh, God, yeah. Yes. Bill O'Hurley. Different, another Irish legend. Yes.
And I think it would have made Dan O'Hurley a star if the film had gotten the wide release that it deserved. But Failsafe, if you're aware of Dr. Strangelove, go watch Failsafe. It's fucking brilliant. 1964.
Those are Vindicator bombers of the Strategic Air Command on routine patrol. Each plane carries 220 megaton hydrogen bombs designed to detonate over enemy targets. At any given moment, night or day, flights of those airplanes are in the air.
Definitely, definitely. Kevin, this is leading me. I'm now coming towards the end of my lecture on POV scenes.
All right. So this is quite a threadbare topic, and it's not the most juicy, because what can you say, really? It's a directorial choice to put you in the emotional state of a character, to show you something that they're seeing. Sometimes it's used to make you feel vulnerable and unsafe. Other times it's to give you the perspective of them on a character that's going to be really important to them, like what you're saying about Royal Tenenbaums. But I will say, I thought I had an opportunity here to talk about two Christmas films, and one of them would be my backup pick. And it's my backup pick only because I feel like we might have mentioned this before on the podcast, because on our Patreon, I did a goofy audio commentary for this film with Podbot.
Right.
No, I did not. I'm now remembering that was for a different thing. Oh, do you know what? Do you know what? Scrap all that.
Right.
I'm going to switch my picks. Okay.
Here we go.
Here we go.
Strap in, folks.
I'm going to do that segment again. So, I was looking around for films to watch for this topic. One of them I went back to, which is one of the very, very earliest POV films. It's a Christmas film. It's not a very good film, but when you think of POV, this is all POV. The entire film is from the point of view of Marlowe, and it's from 1946, and it's The Lady in the Lake.
I've not watched this.
It's a noir.
Tell me more.
Yeah. So you are in the literal shoes of the detective who's investigating the murder of a girl. And he's going around to all these different who could it be characters. He's got the great gumshoe dialogue. The voice of the character, because basically it's almost narrated from his point of view.
My name is Marlowe, Philip Marlowe. Occupation, private detective. You know, somebody says, follow that guy. So I follow him.
Listen here, toots. I ain't got time for this with a waffle. Tell me what you know and tell me quick. It's that kind of stuff. But I found it very watchable. However, it does wear out its welcome. It does lots of like great trick shots. There was a moment where I laughed out loud, actually, because he has a testy confrontation with a character who he believes might have done it. And the character makes a run at him, run at the camera, and pushes him. And the camera stabs back.
Yeah.
And they'll do trick shots where he'll walk past a mirror and you'll see him in the mirror. And he'll take a look at himself and he'll keep walking. But the whole thing is like characters talking directly to him. So you feel like you're playing a video game. You feel like you're playing a character, Marlowe,
right,
who's trying to solve this murder. But it's a Christmas film. And so I was like just in the mood of like enjoying like... Da, 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 da,
you love da, Christmas, da. Yeah?
Yeah. I think this is the only place where this film would ever come up is in this topic. It's all point of view apart from the framing device of the character talking directly to the camera and explaining what he's up to and why he's on this investigation. But other than that, you're dropped literally into his shoes and you watch him go about from house to house on Christmas Eve trying to solve this murder. And it's a gimmick film, but I enjoyed it. It's not a great film. So I would say that it was neck and neck as I was watching it with this other one of being my pick. But it's not my pick. But I thought I'd mention it. So Lady in the Lake is one to watch.
Oh, well, it's I'm adding it to my watch list as we speak.
It's good to watch over Christmas.
Okay. That's really cool. This is great. I love finding new films and kind of go, okay, there's a reason to watch this. For me, and leading up to my pick, right, I went on this winding circuitous route and eventually found myself kind of saying, that film kind of has to be my favorite film that represents POV or POV shots, right? And it involves, why I'm picking is because it involves...
Is this your pick or is this your...
It's just leading into my pick? This is, we're on my pick now, yeah. It involves voyeurism.
Oh, because no, I haven't given you my pick.
Oh, right. Oh, give me your pick, Sona. Please give me your pick. Yes, sorry.
I get to do back to back. Oh, more me in the podcast.
Yeah, please do, yeah. Or no, before you do that, Kevin, before you do that, we have to actually mention the fact that people are probably screaming, you know, to themselves listening to us. Because
Hardcore Henry, talk about Hardcore Henry.
Exactly, because we haven't mentioned Hardcore Henry or the POV scene in Doom, not Dune, but Doom, D-O-O-M, with The Rock and Carol Urban, the adaptation of the video game.
Oh, I love it. It's my favorite.
I'm not a fan of that POV scene. I rewatched it for this, and I feel it's from a person who played all the Doom games. It feels too floaty. It feels really weird. It feels like you're on an amusement park ride. It just does nothing for me, that Doom POV scene. And I haven't seen Hardcore Henry.
Same with video games for me. I'm more of a side scroller guy than a POV guy with games.
A first person shooter type person.
Yeah. So Alien Isolation, I would find that too stressful.
Oh, God.
But, you know, Double Dragon, I'd enjoy that.
Well, one of the most scariest experiences I've ever had playing a video game was playing Resident Evil 7, which I live streamed with the Discord people, and they had a good old laugh at me. And that was in VR. I did that in VR, actually. I did that in VR. How the hell did I do it in VR?
Oh, I remember that.
Terrifying. Yeah. You watched some of it as well. Terrifying experience. Really terrifying. Please, now, Kevin, I want to hear, what is your pick?
Well, it's Christmas time, and I thought I would go with a proper, cozy Christmas film, one that gets me in the mood, that I return to every Christmas, because it gives me all those lovely feelings. And it is Bob Clark's Black Christmas from 1974.
Great.
Easily the most unsettling, frightening, horrible Christmas film that I can think of, other than maybe Love Actually. It does a lot of what Halloween does in a more elegant and beautiful way with that film, but you never see the killer in Black Christmas. You hear the phone calls that he makes, and they're really horrible. But you're aware of his presence. So he's inside the attic of the sorority house as people are going home for Christmas. And you're left with Olivia Hussey, Margot Kidder, a lot of like character actors.
Right.
As he starts to pick people off. And it's very, very frightening. I've said it before on the podcast. It's the last horror film that I can remember or I can recall watching. When I was about 18, I saw it quite late, that properly scared me. And there's a moment where Olivia Hussey, who's been getting all these disturbing phone calls, she's on to the police. The police are outside. They're, you know, providing a very threadbare security detail to look after these girls. Olivia Hussey is going to check on Margot Kidder upstairs because Margot Kidder got drunk and went to bed early. She does not know what's happened to Margot Kidder, and she goes upstairs. And what Black Christmas does better than almost any other horror film is it's silent. You'll hear the ticking of a clock. Tick, tock, tick, tock. As she'll go up the stairs, and she is shitting herself. Something doesn't feel right here, and I need to just check on this. And the sensation that I got through this point of view shot jumped out at me as like, holy shit, I've never experienced that before. And it was a visceral full body reaction where my whole face just went red hot. Like, I flushed so intensely that my face was burning. And it felt like someone had poured ice cold water down my back at the same time.
Okay.
And I was just like, oh, Jesus. But she goes up to the bedroom where Margot Kidder is sleeping. She opens the door jamb, and she looks and she sees what's become of Margot Kidder in this darkened house. And as she's standing there, reeling, going, fuck me, he's in the house.
Mm.
She turns and looks, and right between the door jamb, right behind the door, he's standing there and his eye is looking out. And she looks and sees the eye. And the sensation of like, oh, Jesus. Oh, God. I was about 18, and that was the last time that a horror film in that capacity had got me, where I felt two things. One, which is like, oh, I love that films can still scare the shit out of me. And it'd been a while since that had happened. And it's never happened since. So now when I watch scary films, I will have unease or dread, or like, I don't know what's going to come here. I don't want to watch this. But that full body sensation of like, this is horrible. I am scared.
Mm.
I got that from Black Christmas from a point of view shot. So for the season and for that sensation, that's my pick.
Bob? Phil?
And you reminded me of our old Jump Scares episode with Kate Dolan, where she recalled a real life event that happened to her, where she was in her granny's house and she was, after coming back from school, and she was like, la la la, making a snack for herself. And she looked up, and in a crack in the door that was leading into their garage was someone looking at her. There was an eye, just as you described it right there. And she screamed, and like the eye disappeared, and they don't know who it was. And I'm like,
I told her I was joking. It was just a prank.
Well,
she would just drop it.
I am eventually going to watch Black Christmas, Kevin, especially after that.
You'd love it.
I think I will.
You'd absolutely love it.
You know, we're thinking of doing a big Christmas movie in the hall here, so that's going to be one of
them. Put it on about 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, when it's like,
yeah,
not a creature is stirring, not even the rats in the house.
Yeah.
You'll love it.
There's only one place left to go, and that's my pick.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Topic. You're very excited.
This topic.
Right. So when thinking about this topic, I thought of it from different angles, from the point of view of people being introduced to a whole new world. It's very useful to use a POV to get the audience into the head of the character. It's great in horror films where you can use it from to convey the terror and dread that a person is experiencing when they're being preyed upon. It's also kind of exciting when you're in the shoes of the predator and you're hunting prey. It gives you a sense of, it can give you a sense of power, a sense of, otherworldly menace. And it's also really great to use in romantic situations where you see the love of a character's life very much through their lens. But the thing I think POV shots are really useful for is when we're trying to convey something that all of us are guilty of, and that's a sense of voyeurism. We all love looking out our window and kind of looking at seeing who's walking down the road. There's a bit of a safetiness and a curiosity and a bit of a nosiness that we all have deep in our guts, right? And I think in films, when we get that in films, we're titillated. We kind of know that feeling of like, oh, I'll just follow them now and just see where they're going to. And oh, they brought the bins out early, and oh, he's wearing herself's dressing gown. I have felt that experience. I remember feeling it watching Empire Strikes Back when, you know, we see the moment where the Admiral goes into Darth Vader's meditation chamber and he accidentally sees the helmet being put down on Darth Vader's head, and we see all the scars in his skull, and there's that moment of, oh, I shouldn't have seen that. We also, there's that sense of voyeurism that we get in Being John Malkovich, where, you know, people are enter the portal and they get to sit inside John Malkovich's head as he drinks a cup of coffee and eats some toast and he reads the Wall Street Journal. It's very titillating. But the film, and it's one of my favorite films, and I'm sure I brought it up in the podcast before, but when thinking about this topic, it was the one film that I absolutely had to bring up, because it captures the sense of voyeurism, the excitement of voyeurism like no other, but also the sense of when that voyeurism steps over the line and the subject you've been following sees you watching them, because the sense of being caught watching is awful. It's dreadful. And that film, of course, is Rear Window. And it is incredible. It's an amazing achievement, that bloody film. I adore it. And I totally understand why Jimmy Stewart's entertaining himself by using his telephoto lens, watching his neighbors, because he's bored. And that just boredom, that having that framing device, it's kind of totally understandable, totally relatable, where you're looking at your neighbours because he's nothing else to look at. And as he's, the longer he looks at his neighbours, the more he's kind of gets...
He could have looked at Grace Kelly.
Well, there you go, yeah. And the scene that I love from that is the scene where, you know, of course you've all seen Rear Window. It's where Jimmy Stewart begins to suspect one of his neighbours of having murdered his wife. And he gets Grace Kelly to sneak into his apartment. And the scene I'm going to highlight as my pick for this topic is that scene where Jimmy Stewart and the woman who's coming around nursing him are watching Grace Kelly rummage around the neighbor's house as he sees the actual neighbor returning. He's supposed to be out for a couple of hours, but he actually sees him returning early. And that sense of dread and terror, watching her flee from one room to the next, and the neighbors casually notice that, hang on a second, something's out of place here. And it's this build of tension. And also the moment when the neighbor looks across the park and sees Jimmy Stewart seeing him, it fills you with that chill that we all know of being caught. And that is just an excellent use of point of view, that use of subjectivity, where subjectivity comes to play in the storytelling, where you are in his shoes. You're totally in Jimmy Stewart's shoes in that moment, because you are Jimmy Stewart in that moment effectively. And that is my pick, Kevin, for best POV scene.
Oh, Lisa! Lisa!
Six, Sergeant Allgood.
Hello. Hello. A man is assaulting a woman at 125 West 9th Street, second floor, at the rear. Now, make it fast.
Okay.
L.B. Jeffries. Chelsea 25598.
She's a smart girl.
Smart girl. She'll get herself arrested.
Yeah, it'll get her out of there, won't it?
Look, the wedding ring. Turn out the light, he's seen us.
I had a feeling that one would come up because it's like classic. It's a good complimentary film with Peeping Tom. So, yeah, that wraps up this topic.
Yeah, Psycho, Peeping Tom, and Rear Window should do it as a triple header. Very
definitely
good. I think we've covered it. We've done POV.
That's that one done. I'm glad. I was dreading this episode.
Yeah.
And now I'm glad to have it over us. So, the next episode for us is going to be our best picks of the year. The films that we've enjoyed for this calendar year. I have some of my favorite films already lined up to include, and I need to just see some more to make sure that I've got a full-bodied top 10 list. But that is another main show done.
Yeah, thank goodness. I still have a load of films to catch up on. There's a load of films of screeners there that are just building up, and finding the time to watch them is the problem. But I will find that time somewhere between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m.
Yeah, after you watch Black Christmas.
Yes, that's the plan.
Okay, so if you want to hear more from us, we have a Patreon. And over on our Patreon, we do mini bits episodes, which is kind of like interstitial episodes to this, where we talk about recent releases and what we're watching. And give us a rating and a review on your podcast app of choice. And yeah, happy Christmas, I suppose.
Yeah, happy Christmas. I hope you have a nice, warm, cozy one. And if you're one of those people, you can borrow Peggy's words. Once the dinner is finished, you can stand up and shout at your family.
Thank fuck it's over!
Exactly. That's what I'm going to say every single day.
All right. Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
The Best Bits podcast is produced by Will and Kevin. All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider becoming a Patreon member, where you'll receive bonus shows where we talk about recent releases and what we're up to.
And you'll receive access to our Discord chat room, where we hang out with our listeners.
Search the Best Bits podcast on Patreon or click on the link in the show notes.
And here is a clip from the lad's latest mini bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
Ho, ho, ho!
Mini bits!
Every day is Christmas Day when you're listening to the best bits. Each episode is a gift, it gives you a lift, it's the best bits.
Are you all set for Christmas?
I am so set for Christmas. Yeah! I was going to sing you a Christmas tune, but every Christmas tune just evaporated from my mind.
Oh, no singing on the podcast. No singing. I can't stand singing on the podcast. Does my head.
I'm trying to think. I'm surprised. I'm trying to think. Actually, all Christmas songs have just left my head. Just right now. They've left my head, Kevin.
Will and Kevin back on the mic here again. That's a teaser for the second episode. We've got so much to get through, Will, that we're going to split this episode into two. So there'll be a second mini bits in a few days' time.
Ooh, very good.
And yeah, we will talk about stuff like Nosferatu and Black Doves and the agency on that. But we've got so much to get through that we thought we would spread it out. Yeah. So you get double Christmas, like divorced kids.
Divorced kids.
Two Christmases.
We have a shit ton of stuff to discuss because it's that time of year. I have become conditioned now to feeling like Christmas is not just Christmas, but it's also movie Christmas because all the good stuff is coming out now. and but it all comes like a big dump truck reversing up and just tipping its load onto me, and I have to watch it all.
Sound effect. Are you doing your leg in the movie club thing? I saw on the Discord you were talking about you were going to screen Die Hard or something.
Yeah, Sunday night, everything is, well, the date is booked. So Sunday evening, this is the plan. This is the new plan. So the plan is we're doing an informal.
Fucking sucks, I'm barred.
It's an informal, so we're not advertising it because it's going to be just kind of the local, whatever, word of mouth thing, families. We're doing a family Christmas-themed movie at 6 on Sunday night in Legony Hall. And then at 9...
And then a family punch-up afterwards.
I'm doing at 9. Maybe the family punch-up might happen in between the first feature, and then at 9, I'm doing the grown-up Christmas movie at 9.
You can't have Christmas without a family punch-up. That's part of the whole thing.
You know what? I think we're going to leave it to Christmas Day.
Did you ever hop the shit out of each other growing up on Christmas?
No. Do you know what? I don't know. Honest to God, I remember our Christmases generally being quite tranquil because I just remember being focused on my toys. That's what it was. I just remember being kind of like just 100% toy-centric or toy-focused. I don't remember.
What was your favourite toy as a kid?
I remember, I suppose maybe I can't remember my favourite toy, but I can remember my favourite Christmas morning, which was like, I remember it was about Luke's age, maybe 9, 10 or something like that. And I remember Santa's been, you know, Santa's come. My brother's
Santa's
waking me up.
Come.
It was always the case that my brothers woke me up. The brothers were always up first and they were the ones who woke me up. And I remember just opening
and
this.
And they let you in from outside.
Yeah, fair play to them, like, you know, out from the coal shed, like, you know. And I always, and my stuff was, generally my Santy used to come and leave my presents at the foot of my bed. And I remember this one particular year, it was in like big, huge Dunstores plastic bag, which I thought was so incredibly on brand. So amazing that Santy managed to.
And then it was a wax jacket.
It was a Dunstores plastic bag. And I remember just extracting the toys from it and just being blown away. I was like going, how did he get me this? I didn't even know I liked this, but he knew I'd like it. Like, he was giving me gifts I'd never asked for or never even saw. He was like, but somehow he knew how to get me the things I loved. So, yeah.
Did you ever go to a store Santa, like into Santa's grotto and sit in his lap?
Yeah, I remember going to him when I was younger, but we didn't. I remember going to one in Ballyvillane, actually, you know, near your neck of the woods. Remember Ballyvillane, the Dunstores in Ballyvillane?
Cork. I do. Is it still going, Ballyvillane?
That's the one that we used to go to Ballyvillane every Friday night.
Yeah. No, I went to a Santa in Jury's Inn once. I don't know why.
Ooh.
And I went and I got a crappy. So I think I've told you this before, but I got a Star Wars figure. This would have been in the late 80s.
Wow.
So Star Wars was long gone. So this is probably something from a bargain bin.
Yeah.
And it was what's his face? The fat slug guy. Yoda. No, what's his name?
Jabba the Hutt.
Jabba the Hutt. Jabba the Hutt's consigliere. Oh. Or his fucking... The guy with the Bib, snake ears.
Bib Fortuna is his name.
Yeah, so I got a Bib Fortuna toy and I was like, what is this disgusting yolk? Like, what is this? Couldn't do anything with it. I thought it was horrible. And other people were getting like... They were getting the speed bikes or whatever those things are.
Yeah, the racers, yeah.
And so it all began then where I just thought, like, I got shit out of fucking luck again. Like, what's this yuck?
Do you know, it's funny because they obviously were acquired from the same bargain bin because I probably, that Christmas that I was going, oh my God, I can't believe I got this, I was getting the same Bib Fortuna. I was getting other, you know, members from Jabba's entourage and retinue, and I got that speeder bike as well, that when you press the button it exploded, it just went pow, and all the pieces, it blew up in your face.
They're doing another Star Wars, obviously, but they just cast your man from the Bear as Jabba the Hutt's son. Is he called Stinky?
Stop. Is that really a true bit of casting? Is it really?
Yeah, I might be misremembering it, but your man from the Bear, the guy that looks like Gene,
oh my God,
Gene
Simmons.
Wilder.
Yeah,
Gene Simmons. Actually, Gene Simmons has Jabba the Hutt's Fucking Jabba the Hutt. Jabba the Hutt's tongue. You can tell that I'm not a Star Wars fan.
Well, you know, at least he's not cast as... Anyway, that's interesting.
But do you know that character? Do you know who I'm talking about?
Oh,
Jabba the Hutt had a son.
Yeah, from the animated show. I think he appeared in like the Clone Wars or something like that. You know,
is he called Stinky?
Jesus, I remember it was... Wouldn't be something that I was a mad fan on. I don't know if he was called Stinky or not. Golly gee, I'm just thinking about what's his name, the guy from The Bear, and kind of going, wow.
Golly gee, you sound like fucking
of all Clark the Kent. Roles of all the roles you could, you know, ask for in the Star Wars universe, you get Stinky the Hutt. You know, I don't know.
That's swell.
Oh god, I'm looking forward to that.
If you had to play anyone in the Star Wars universe, who would you like to play?
He's not called Stinky, he's called Rota the Hutt.
Where did I get Stinky from?
I do not know. Is Rota.
Okay. Rota the Hutt. Okay.
And I wonder what he looked like, because if I remember, he is a like a hut, you know. He is a hut. So what were you asking me there? It's unusual. It's so unusual.
It probably looked like Fat Bastard.
Yeah.
I said, if you could play anybody in Star Wars, who would you play?
Oh,
what character would you like to roleplay as?
Oh, who would I like?
Because we're doing a Star Trek RPG. We did the Alien one recently.
Yeah.
And there's a whole gang of us getting together in the new year, and we're going to be playing as new characters. I've already picked up my character. I'm the chief medical officer, Dr. Pashaw.
Oh, very
he's
good.
He's half Klingon and half Vulcan.
Yeah.
So he's basically bipolar. No! So, you know, he's like, that would be acceptable.
I have to, over Christmas now, I'm going to get my shit together and I'm going to figure out who my character is for that, because it sounds like it's going to be great fun.
Well, we both know you're not going to get your shit together. That's part of your character makeup at this stage.
Yeah.
You are a fly by the seat of your pants type, and I am a stranglehold, detail orientated, OCD type, and we gel so well together. We just...
But it's very true. That's it. We're two totally different. We're two totally different approaches to doing this. I am absolutely fly by the seat of my pants. Just like, yeah, we'll do it. Yeah, whatever. Let's figure it out. We'll make it up as we go. That's my attitude.
But who would you play in Star Wars if you had to pick a character?
I'm going to be a random TIE fighter pilot. You know, someone who's in a ship. General, I think I'm going to be with the Empire, and I just want to be. I want to be earning a wage, a weekly wage. And have a very clear chain of command and answer to the boss and all hail the Empire. That's who I'd be.
I'd probably be one of the Chewbaccas.
You're really demonstrating your throat gargle abilities, yeah. Your throat gargling talents.
I was delighted with myself that actually the Predator, and I thought afterwards, if people listen to the last episode where I did a Predator noise, they're going to think that that's fake. They're going to think that that's the sound effect.
Yeah,
I did that.
Well done.
That was me. I don't know how many people can do that, but... I remember being in a call center with, it's funny enough, this guy was Taika Waititi's assistant for the longest time. Do you know the way I have these friendships that sort of develop in my life, and these people go on to work in the film industry, and we never knew that we had the same interests at the time.
What the fuck?
So Neil Sharma, he's a big, tall, like Australian fella, sound lad. We worked together in a call center in Sydney.
Yeah.
And we were on different campaigns, but you know, you're all hanging out together. It was such a great crack, that job. But I remember that that I did the Chewbacca sound for Neil.
Yeah.
And that's when we became friends, because he thought that was the funniest fucking thing. He never expected it from me. And it sticks out my mind, because this is, you know, where somebody says something to you and you think, fucking hell, what did you think of me? Where they say, I didn't think you had it in you. Or they say something like, I wasn't too keen on you, to be honest, when I first met you, but you're actually sound.
Yeah.
That kind of like backhanded compliment.
Yeah.
And he thought that I was a boring cunt until I did that. And we became like friends after that, because the way to my heart is to insult me. It's
Why didn't you tell me this sooner, Kevin, you fucking prick? You're a horrible, horrible cunt.
But Neil went on to be a director, and he was Taika Waititi's assistant for the longest time. So I would constantly see him popping up all over the place, because you can't miss Neil. He's about 6'6".
But wow. Yeah. This is, that's totally, this is the first time you've ever mentioned this to me. It's mad.
Isn't it great that we still have things to tell each other?
Are you still in touch with him?
I am, yeah. He was messaging me just... what did he... He messaged me... He messaged me the other... about a month or so ago, and it had been... I can't remember the specifics now, but it was either I messaged him or he messaged me, and I replied a year later because it was on Instagram, and I never use Instagram.
Yeah, okay.
So... I've done that in the past where I will like reply to somebody's message on Facebook 5 years later.
Yeah. It says, oh yeah, I'm fine. Then it will happen to me. If you message me on social media, there's a high chance that's going to happen. Your message will just get lost or spammed or something like that.
I'd say that if you walked up to you and said hello, there's a good chance that you'd probably get ignored as well. You are just too in famous. Your own world.
I'm too famous. That's what it is. I'm too high and mighty.
Well, do you know what? To take us from talking about Star Wars into talking about Star Wars.
Yeah.
I watched the first episode of that new show that came out, Skeleton Crew.
I watched the first episode of that new show called Skeleton Crew.
Mini bits.